Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Act and Perspective Podcast. I'm your host, Hugh Simonick. Now, Dr. George Diggs is a well-respected, well-researched evolutionary biologist and botanist who has taught at Austin College in Sherman, Texas for 40 years. I took my first evolutionary biology and ecology class with him over 30 years ago. His research interests include evolution as it relates to human health, climate change, the plains of Texas, and biogeography. He has co-authored 4 books and nearly 40 scientific articles, traveling and completing research in all 7 continents. Now, one of his latest books is The Hunter-Gatherer Within, Health and the Natural Human Diet, co-authored with Dr. Kerry Brock. For the past 15 years, he has focused on evolutionary medicine and ancestral health, and recently he helped establish an undergraduate program in public health at Austin College. Now, in this episode, George brings a clear understanding between evolutionary and environmental science, public health, and human behavior. He discusses how we evolved genetically and culturally from our origins in small hunter-gatherer groups to where we are today, comparing the stark differences between the two, noting very different individual and group selective pressures that not only explains why we engage in behaviors we know are harmful to us, but what we can do about them. Now, along these lines, he clearly explains important concepts in evolutionary and behavioral science, such as cognitive bias, evolutionary mismatch, cultural catalysis, and epigenetics, and then uses this understanding as a foundation to reflect on needed policy shifts. Now, George Diggs is one of those great contributors to life that not only has decades of experience under his belt as a research scientist, but is at heart a well-loved and respected mentor and teacher to thousands who genuinely cares about the welfare of others. So please help welcome Dr. George M. Diggs.
One thing that has become increasingly recognized since the time you were at Austin College, I mean, we realized it then, but the implications were not as clear, the idea of the brain as an evolved system, the impact of how evolution affects the way our brains work, affects our behavior, and it's very, very broad reaching. So for example, some obvious stuff, you can call it a sub-processing system or a particular part of the brain or whatever, that deals with face recognition, right? We all know that. Different areas of the brain control speech versus understanding speech. So we know that there are parts of the brain that have evolved to do certain things. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously there's tremendous connections, but there are also more subtle effects. I like to think of them as cognitive biases. Hunter-gatherers, where we spent 99% of our evolutionary history as a lineage, as hunter-gatherers. And in that context, certain behaviors were selected for. We were selected to be particularly alert to danger, for instance. And so one spinoff of that, one cognitive bias resulting from that, would be something is sometimes called loss aversion. So we're much more sensitive to losing something than winning something. And this has implications in a whole host of fields, including finance and economics. One of the ways that I think, though, our evolved biases affects us individually is that we are very good at dealing with immediate threats, things that are in front of us right now, that are obvious threats. Humans did not evolve well to deal with long-term thinking, to deal with problems that we face decades in the future. And so let me give you a few examples. We can very easily, if we were out hiking, if you and I were hiking somewhere in a wildlife refuge and a bison came after us, we would be very good at escaping from that bison, right? We'd climb a tree, we'd run, we'd jump a fence. Humans, though, can know intellectually that smoking is very, very harmful.
Yeah.
And that if you look at the statistics, it increases all kinds of things. But it's easy to not think about that now. It's easy to not deal with the long term. One of the ways that I think causes particularly a lot of suffering in our society, in a society like ours where money is such a big deal, is that many people don't save anything for retirement. They are focused on the here and now. And that causes all kinds of problems, including physical and mental health problems as people age because of the stress and the uncertainty of life if they reach, you know, my age without any resources. And so our brains are evolved in one context, and now here we are in a different context, and we can train ourselves, obviously. You know, the human brain is remarkable in that we can train ourselves to do all kinds of things, but we have to literally be trained or train ourselves towards certain types of thinking because that may not be the kind of the built-in cognitive bias that we have as a species. Mm-hmm. So I think it's becoming more and more recognized that the brain is an evolved system and that we do have some built-in routines that in some cases serve us well and in some cases don't serve us well.
And so is it necessary that we have an understanding of the evolutionary context and the history to know how to solve the problems that we have today?
I don't think it's really necessary to understand. I think, though, there are many different approaches that reach different people, obviously, right? There's in your field, there, I'm sure you apply very different techniques to different different clients. I think for some people, being able to understand what's going on may be helpful. It can be helpful in the behavioral area. It can also be helpful, I think, in other things that affect people's happiness. For example, dietary things. For some people, actually being able to understand why you should eat a certain way is a much stronger motivator than just telling them, do this or do that. Now, that's a subset of people, obviously. Some people want to understand, kind of look behind the curtain. Other people don't care. They just want to be told what to do. Right. But, you know, as an academic, I guess I'm biased in a way. I like to understand what's going on. It doesn't work well with me if somebody just tells me to do something and but doesn't tell me why it matters, you know.
Yeah,
exactly. I like to understand. And, you know, probably a lot of your listeners are biased in that way too, because they spend their careers trying to figure out what's going on to help their clients or whatever. So, but no, I don't think you necessarily have to understand this, but I think it's helpful as particularly in clinicians figure out how to approach things. It does help to understand what's behind the scenes.
You know, we have a tendency to misuse our information about evolutionary theory,
right? Absolutely.
And we have misused it in the past in regard to, say, IQ and inheritance,
right?
Where I think it was once said that 80% of IQ is inherited. So, you know, those people who are not fitting that certain standard are doomed. And so it just kind of fed the arguments of racism and sexism and the structured hierarchy that we have today. So what makes us think, that we're now on the right track as opposed to where we were in the 70s and 80s?
So one thing that I think as scientist, whether research scientist or applying science, one thing we have to constantly keep in mind is that we can be wrong and that we need to correct. So I actually begin my courses telling students that the most important thing about being a scientist is being able to admit you're wrong and then going from there. And that's it's unfortunate in the public sphere if somebody learns something new and changes their mind, they're criticized for that.
Yeah.
And so I think we always have to approach things carefully and watch for information that would indicate that we are incorrect. We are almost certainly incorrect about many things. If one thing looking at the history of science tells us is that, just as you said, we've made a lot of mistakes, but the scientific approach is the most effective approach we've ever found. It's not perfect. You know, there are lots of screw-ups, but the application of science has done more probably to improve the human condition than virtually anything else. If, you know, we only have to go back a few centuries when virtually all psychological conditions were considered to be the manifestation of supernatural forces. You've been affected by the evil eye. You're possessed by a demon. You've been cursed. God is taking out his retribution on you. You've been possessed by a devil. You've had sex with a succubus or an incubus, a demonic spirit that's coming down to, you know. And in fact, there are people today still who think that physical and mental maladies are the result of some kind of either evil spirit or so, you know, but fortunately, science has pushed back that supernatural thinking so that now we look at most types of human disease, literally dis-ease. So human dis-ease, and I would include, you know, both physical and mental suffering in that disease or dis-ease category. We look at that as the result of physical causes that we can then deal with. There's a very famous book called The Demon-Haunted World, Science as a Candle in the Dark. It was written by a physicist and astronomer named Carl Sagan. And he's basically saying that science is like a candle in the dark. It's shining light to push back this dark superstition, basically, that had cloaked any understanding of physical reality. And so I think we have to be very careful, but science has certainly uncovered a tremendous amount in a remarkably short period of time.
Yeah, it has. And, you know, I'm reminded, you know, there's a group of people that kind of bridge the gap that we both know. So so David Sloan Wilson is one of them. Do you think that we're now, like, have all the right pieces of information to move forward? Or do you think that we're actually still lacking something significant to create the change that we need?
I think, so Hugh, that's an interesting question. So it makes me think back, you know, near the end of the 1800s, a question like that was asked to some well-known physicist, and he basically, you know, said, everything's coming into place. And of course, that was before Einstein discovered, you know, much of modern physics. And so I think that we're going to learn a tremendous amount in the future. So just as an example, I think it's going to turn out, and we can talk more about this as we go through the podcast, but the whole field of epigenetics. So how our genes are turned on and off. I'm not talking about changing the actual gene. I'm just talking about turned on and off. I think that is going to turn out to be remarkably important in the field of behavioral science, all aspects of behavioral science, because we now understand that virtually everything we do turns genes on and off. If you get up and go into the kitchen and drink a half gallon of Coca-Cola, that's not just going to make you feel bad. That's going to turn genes on and off. Right. And on the other hand, if you go out and you swim 4 miles tomorrow, that's going to turn genes on and off. And those switches can have profound long-term implications. Stress turns genes on and off. And so I think in the future, we're going to understand a lot more about that. We're just now peeking into the whole field of epigenetics.
Yeah.
But we know it has profound consequences. You know, one of the behavioral things that I think is almost certainly epigenetically controlled is fairly rare, and you probably know a lot more about this than I do. Some people call it psychosocial stunting, where children have been horribly abused and they simply quit growing physically.
Right.
So, you know, obviously if a human's growth can be turned off, that's something's going on at the genetic level. Genes have been turned on or off.
Yeah.
And if you think about if stress can manifest in something that profound, what is it doing to the mental processing and all the psychological implications of that? And it's kind of mind-boggling. And we don't know what genes are being turned on or off. What are we doing at the level of neurotransmitters? What are we doing at the level of stress hormones like cortisol? I don't know, but I think epigenetics is going to be seen as underlying a lot of that. And I don't think that's being talked about very much, except in probably pretty small corners of the mental health world right now.
Yeah. Can you go into more about what epigenetics is?
Right. So we all have in ourselves DNA, and the sequence of this we call genes. And these genes make proteins, which are the molecules that cause a lot of the things to happen in our body. So, and we can't change our genes. You are not going to be changing your genes. I'm not going to change my genes. We're genetically set. We got those from our parents. But different environmental factors can cause genes to be turned on or off. And genes are supposed to be turned on. Some genes are supposed to be turned on and some are supposed to be turned off at different stages in our life. If we're exposed to something and that turns on or off the wrong genes, like an on-off switch, or I like to think it doesn't necessarily turn it on or off. It's like cranks up the dial. It's like you're turning the heat up on your stove. Virtually everything we do does this. So diet, exercise, stress, exposure to chemicals, smoking. And this can have a profound impact when it happens early in life. So intrauterine development. So a fetus is in the mother's uterus, and she is exposed to some type of chemical. Okay. During the process of development, genes are being turned on and off constantly as the body develops. But if you throw in some external factor that's not supposed to be happening, and you start messing around with those switches, the baby does not develop properly. And we now know from animal studies, and obviously you can't do these things in humans, we now know in animal studies that chemical exposure, if a fetus, or let's say if a mother is exposed to chemicals, a mother mouse or rat is exposed to chemicals, that chemical exposure not only affects her, we now know that it can affect at least 4 generations.
Wow.
So it can affect her developing fetus, it can affect the developing fetus's offspring, and it can affect the developing fetus's great-grandchildren.
And just one exposure?
One exposure of an individual creature can affect multiple generations into the future. Now, that has profound consequences for humans, because our developmental biology is, you know, scarcely different from what happens in a mouse at the genetic and the developmental level. You know, genes are turned on, genes are turned off. What does that mean for us? What does it mean that the chemicals we're being exposed to today, some of which affect, mental processing, what does that mean not to just this person, but to their great grandchild. Mm-hmm. That's pretty astonishing. Mm-hmm. And we are doing things now in our society that make no sense, and that traditional peoples, many of them, were very careful about. So in this country, we often spend very little money on maternal and child care. So I focus a lot on public health. And one of the best investments a society can make is to devote resources to maternal and child health. Because if you put money in there, you're going to save yourself a lot of trouble down the line. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's a whole field called the developmental origins of disease. The most consequential time in an individual's life is that 9 months of intrauterine development. And if a mother is properly nourished, if a mother is protected from chemical exposure, if a mother is not put in such a stressful environment, that has profound consequences. And we know this from, there's a host of research studies, and they date back decades. We don't put a lot of resources in our culture in that. You know, a pregnant woman, if she doesn't have any resources, she's probably going to be under tremendous stress. And particularly in the state of Texas, our social safety net, our health care for indigent people, is shockingly substandard compared to most of the rest of the nation. If you look at some hunter-gatherer societies or some traditional diet societies, traditional peoples, they often had special foods that were given to pregnant women, special foods that were given to lactating women, things that were known among that group, having, you know, learned this over untold generations, that were most nourishing and would give the best chance for the offspring to thrive. Those societies understood it and applied those techniques. Our society, we're so much more advanced, quote, whatever that means. We're more technologically advanced, but we're not necessarily more advanced in how we apply some things that should be common sense.
Yes, right. Obviously, there's a deficit there. That we're not doing, there's variation, but there's a disparity in how people are treated. How much of that has to do with just a lack of education, and how much of that has to do with intention?
So I don't know. I like to approach life in assuming good intentions in people. It seems to work better. That's what my life experience has taught me. I do better if I approach other individuals as, with good intentions. But from what I see over decades now, I've lived in Texas for, you know, many decades, I don't see that our legislature necessarily allocates funding in a way that cares about people who are not doing well. And one of the most obvious examples is the lack of expansion of Medicaid in Texas. Texas is one of, I don't know how many states, but one state that has not upgraded Medicare, even though the federal government's will pay a very high percentage of that. That to me indicates there is actual intentionality going on. But we know there's intentionality going on for, I would say, cruel reasons. For example, at the national level, the most obvious was separating families at the border. We know that separating children, we've known this for hundreds of years. You can't take a child away from its parent and not have some kind of effects. And I'm sure in your field, you can enumerate an astonishing list of bad consequences of taking a child, isolating it away from its parents, the stress and the trauma of that and that was intentionally done to scare people and prevent the flow of migration. Now, we could argue about whether you want to have certain levels of migration, but Taking children from their parents seems to me to be a very intentional way to actually frighten people, because it's such a horrifying thing.
Yeah, well, it leads me to my next question too, because this seemed to be a theme in human history. This is nothing right. new, right? I mean, we have been struggling with, you know, genocide, war, atrocities for the length of since we evolved. I mean, what is it that's part of ourselves that we need to be aware of that creates these conditions?
So I don't pretend to be an expert in this, but I have thought a good bit about this, kind of the duality of human nature. So on the one hand, there's almost no species that can be as cooperative as humans. You know, humans that have no genetic relationship, family relationship, can cooperate wonderfully with other individuals. So we have this amazing ability to cooperate, but we also have this astonishing ability to be just the opposite, to compete or actually to kill other members of our species. And I think in some ways, this is an example of a much broader theme that I think is crucially important. And that's the idea of evolutionary mismatch. And so let me develop that a little and then come back to this duality of human nature. So we evolved as a species in one context. We evolved as hunter-gatherers. But in the modern world, we live in a totally different environment, very different from the one we evolved in. Our lineage evolved on the African savanna. We evolved as hunter-gatherers in small groups. And there's debate about group size, but probably somewhere 20 to 40 individuals, something like that, small groups. And these would interact with other small groups, but we evolved as hunter-gatherers. Now, if you think about a small group, cooperation is highly advantageous, because you can't survive if you don't cooperate with your small group. And lone human is a helpless creature. You could take the strongest human, the best conditioned human you want, you put that person out in the African savannah by himself or herself, he's not gonna last long, right? But you take a small group, we could go out and pick 30 people at random, you and I, and we could go out on the African savannah, and as long as you had somebody that had a little knowledge of the natural world, we'd be able to survive. Somebody would stay up at night and keep the fire going to keep the lions away, for example, right? Cooperation was critically important. In hunter-gatherer societies, and anthropologists have studied these now, there aren't many left, but over the past couple of centuries, anthropologists have studied a lot of hunter-gatherers. And I've gotten to go to some places where there are people living not as hunter-gatherers, but living at least partially that way, areas in the Amazon, for instance. If you think about a hunter-gatherer group, what if there was a person in a hunter-gatherer group, say a male, that abused women or slapped children around, you know, abused children, and that individual abused your mate? Well, probably what's going to happen to that individual is during the night, somebody's going to go over there and take a rock and knock him in the head, right? That's not going to last. And so we see in hunter-gatherer groups, there are some social constraints over some of the negative aspects of human behavior. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I think there are evolved mechanism for cooperation in our species. We're just amazingly cooperative. But like all species, individuals try to maximize their own survival and reproduction. But I think in a hunter-gatherer society, the way we live for for many, many thousands of generations, there were social constraints that kept the most negative aspects of our behavior in check. But let's go to the modern world then. In the modern world, greed and abuse of other people can get by without any consequences, because in a modern society, there's a lot of anonymity, but also in a modern society, wealth can cover up almost any offense. But in a hunter-gatherer society, that's not the case. You do not find in hunter-gatherer societies some of the worst aspects of what we see in modern society. And I think that, I think that modern society is so different from the way we evolved that a lot of things can happen that aren't controlled. Now, humans have tried to put laws and other things into effect that prevent this. But as we know, that's very imperfectly done. Another thing, for example, in hunter-gatherer societies, women are not marginalized. The role of women is as important as the role of men. There's some division of labor, but men are not dominating women the way we see happening in many modern societies. That just in what goes on in hunter-gatherer societies. And so I think that we are existing now in a modern world in an environment so different from the one we evolved in that there are profound consequences.
Yeah.
Is that too much rambling?
No, that's perfect. It brings to mind, you remember I posed a question in regard to evolutionary mismatch and putting that in the proper philosophical framework, right? I understand the concept of evolutionary mismatch, that we have changed to the point that is not, in recent years, that is not consistent with our evolutionary past.
Right.
However, we are speaking within a framework that somehow our behavior is beyond evolution, that we're stepping outside of evolution, and that we have made mistakes. Well, evolution doesn't make mistakes. With our behavior, everything is part of evolution. So how could we then say that evolutionary mismatch makes sense if everything, including our behavior, our brains, everything, has evolved to the point it is now?
Okay, so I guess my response would be genetic change, actually changing of genes, is very, very slow. Okay, so let's just take me as an example. I'm 69 years old, and my father was born in 1911. Okay, now I have not, there's not been, there's one generation away from 1911, right? So genetic change isn't occurring. And genetic change literally takes many, many, many generations to have significant genetic change. But let's look at the cultural difference from the way things were when my father was born, or even when I was born, and the way they are now. Mm-hmm. So I remember my father telling me he remembered seeing his first car. Mm-hmm. Okay. When I was a boy, I would go down to my neighbors who didn't have a bathroom. She didn't have water in the house, and we would pull water out of a well using a rope and a bucket. One of those wheels you've seen in the old movies, somebody pulls water out of a well. Culture has changed tremendously. My father lived from literally using horse and buggy and never seeing his first car to the computer age. You have lived, during your much shorter lifetime than me, you've lived through a total transformation in how people interact with information. The cell phone, basically, and screens. And that is having profound effects. That's a cultural change. That has nothing to do with genetics. That's a cultural change. That's having profound effects, as I understand it. And again, I'm outside, when I say this, I'm outside of my field, but I'm interested in in the impacts of culture on behavior and psychological processes, that has pretty profound effects on some developing adolescents. The constant use of screens can be pretty serious, as I understand it. You were not exposed to that. We cannot adapt genetically to that. So the basic idea that I'm talking about in humans is that culture is changing or evolving. Our cultures evolve, right? Culture is evolving very, very rapidly. Genetic change is slow. Therefore, we have this mismatch, this incompatibility. And we have to, I think what we have to do is figure out, at the end of the day, how do we, recognizing this mismatch, how do we do things in a way that best match our genes, but still allow us to take maximal advantage of all of the wonderful opportunities and advancement of the modern world? You know, how do we maximize human happiness and potential? But in order to do that, we've got to, at least to a certain extent, have our behavior match our biology, because otherwise we're going to get into trouble. Mm-hmm. So let's take a simplistic example. That's exercise. Mm-hmm. You know, we can literally now sit on our couches and do nothing all the time. You know, and particularly in the age of Zoom, you sit, we've all been trapped in our chairs or in our standing desk or whatever. But the human body does not do well in the long run without movement. That's just all there is to it. Literally, I could go through in detail all the changes that happen to the human body if you don't get some exercise, if you don't get movement. But the modern world has made it so that we don't have to move. We can, and there are many people that literally almost do nothing. And the consequences are profound. By the time they get older, they have sarcopenia, muscle loss. They develop, they're not able to balance properly. They fall, they injure themselves. You know, they don't reach their potential. We have to, as living organisms, exercise if we want to maintain health. And this, I'm not talking just about physical health. Now we know that exercise is probably the best thing, I would think, to one of the best things to prevent age-related, mental deterioration, dementia of various sorts. You know, when you exercise, you increase levels of brain-derived neurotrophic factor and all kinds of things, right? I mean, we have to move. We're not going to get around that. 1,000 years from now, if there are humans on Earth, they're going to still have to move their bodies, or they're not going to do well, because that's how we evolved. And 1,000 years is not a long time from this perspective of genetics. 1,000 years is literally like that.
Right, right. But when you're talking about epigenetics, though, that's part of the rapid change that interacts with cultural evolution, is it not?
Exactly, right? Exactly. So we can turn our genes on and off.
Yeah.
But we're not changing the underlying genes, but we can have a tremendous impact on our phenotypes, on how we turn out.
Right.
And so one of the things that I think is going to, one of the reasons epigenetics is so important is it's going to be a bridge between these. If we mm-hmm. can understand how to turn things on and off, and in fact, people are already applying these techniques. There are cancer therapies that are based on epigenetics now, on trying to turn certain genes. You know, there are tumor suppressor genes and genes that more can increase the chance of cancer. If we can turn certain genes on and off, that's going to be helpful. And I think in the future, that's going to be applied much more broadly. And who knows? Who knows? 500 years from now, your descendant, who's a psychologist, may be saying, well, we have this patient, we need to apply this epigenetic therapy to maximize the chance of reducing their obsessive compulsive disorder, or what, you know, I mean, who knows?
Yeah. Yeah, no, thank you so much for drawing a distinction between cultural evolution, genetic evolution. I think that we think of when we hear evolutionary theory and hear all these terms associated with evolution, that we're painting it with one broad stroke. And genetic evolution, biological and genetic evolution is different, but also similar to what we're talking about, cultural evolution, where traits are learned, traits are passed down from generation to generation. That then it sounds like the intermediary between the two is epigenetics.
In many ways, I think that's a fair way to say it.
Okay, all right.
You know, let me give you another example, I think, that might help here. There's a genetic, there's a mutation. So, you know, obviously we can have genetic mistakes. There's genetic mutation that causes a condition known as xeroderma pigmentosa. Xeroderma pigmentosa. And this is a genetic defect that causes the body to not be able to repair damage caused by ultraviolet light. So, you know, if you and I go out, we can get a tan, we could get sunburned, but we can go out and our body, our skin is able to repair itself. But people with this condition cannot repair themselves. And so the common name for people who have this, kids who have this, is called moon children, because they literally can't get any exposure to the sun. Any. I mean, if they get any exposure, they have very serious consequences, because they have a, you know, it'd be a horrible condition to have. Mm-hmm. Now, but most humans have evolved to be able to protect against sun damage, because we evolved in an environment where we were exposed to the sun, right? Now let's fast forward to the modern world and look at a very different thing. In the modern world, we can now be exposed to a host of addictive drugs, mm-hmm. right? A host of them. Some naturally derived compounds from plants that have been purified, but some that have been, you know, designer drugs that have been made. Mm-hmm. We have not evolved genetic mechanisms to defend ourselves against addictive drugs. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, it's not surprising to me that we have a lot of problems with addiction in our society, because we are confronted with a cultural phenomenon. The availability of addictive drugs, that's a cultural phenomenon, but we don't have a biological defense. We don't have a genetically evolved defense. Now, we can try to develop ways to protect ourselves, you know, psychological tools, legal tools, but we don't have, it's not like we can just defend ourselves against the sun, right? Does that make any sense? Is that not an analogy help?
Yeah, it does. I can make sense of that in terms of the distinction between genetic and biological evolution and culture evolution. Culture evolution right. seems to be like what we're in control of. But when you're standing back in a kind of 30,000 foot observation, there's a complexity to this that is overwhelmingly large, it's hubris to think that we have any kind of control over what we're going to do and how we're going to shape and move humanity. All these negative things that we describe are maybe necessary things that we need to go through as human beings in order to get to a better end.
I totally agree that it's hubris. And it's not just hubris. I think it's also extremely short-sighted. We can't know what, as a species, we're going to need in the future, right? I mean, that's the best argument against trying to manipulate the human genome. I mean, we're at the place now where we can literally manipulate our genes.
Yeah.
And that's probably going to be done in some totalitarian society. You know, it's probably going to be happening. But we don't know what we're going to need in the future. And we don't even understand enough at this point to to know whether we would do something horribly wrong that would have very bad long-term consequences. So right. I totally agree, it's hubris. I think there are some things though that we can do that do not risk such long-term devastating consequences. I mean, we can apply our understanding of evolution in ways that I think are helpful to us, very helpful to us, and at the behavioral level. So you kind of painted the broad picture, and I agree completely, but I try to be very practical, but probably partly because I grew up on a farm. So how do we maximize human potential?
Yeah.
Well, you know, one thing, for example, let's take the development of the human brain. Everything, you know, if we're going to talk about behavior, at the bottom line, you've got to have the brain to behave, and the brain has got to be developed properly. So how do we get the brain to develop properly in kids? Mm-hmm. Well, one very important thing is the availability of certain fatty acids to properly construct the brain. So there are these fatty acids, I won't give the detailed scientific name, but they're called EPA and DHA. They're omega-3, they're called omega-3 fatty acids, and people have heard of those. You can buy capsules to take them. And you find these in things like cold water fish. But you also find it in the body tissue of ruminant animals in fairly large concentrations. So if you were a hunter-gatherer on the African savanna, you'd be getting EPA and DHA from the meat you're eating. But if you had access to any kind of seafood, you'd be getting it as well. Mm. You also get from animals vitamin B12 from animal tissue, vitamin B12. And if we do not have vitamin B12, that causes neurological problems. Mm-hmm. Okay. So in pregnant women, you have to have EPA and DHA for the brain of their fetuses to develop properly. Mm-hmm. But in the modern world, there's so little understanding about even the most basic dietary principles. Mm-hmm. So women who are vegans, for example, that is a pretty serious thing if they're not knowledgeable enough to supplement. Humans did not evolve to be vegans. I'm sorry, there's never been a natural human culture mm-hmm. that's ever been looked at that was vegan. And there's a reason. We didn't evolve that way. Mm-hmm. So how do we get brains to develop properly? So I think we can apply our evolutionary understanding. We know that we evolved in a certain way. We can apply it in a way that helps manifest in helping children, helping maximize human happiness. Now, that's at a very practical level as compared to how do we shape cultures?
Yeah.
Right? And I think there are some ways we can shape cultures. Mm-hmm. In our country right now, we're faced with a lot of challenges. You know, we have this anti-vaccine, anti-vax frenzy. And that is something that culturally is problematic. We have an anti-science attitude in many ways. We have climate change denial. Mm-hmm. I think anybody who lives in Texas has been seeing the consequences of climate change, you know, particularly the weather extremes that we can't prove any particular weather event, but we just had a weather extreme in Texas that was pretty astonishing, right? and I wouldn't be surprised if that was linked to global climate change. That is something as a species that we've got to come to grips with, or there's going to be human suffering.
Yeah.
There's a woman, Margaret Chan, who was director of World Health Organization in the relatively recent past. And she said that climate change, I don't have her exact quote in front of me, but basically she said that climate change is going to be the defining issue for public health of the 21st century.
Yeah.
And you know, your children or your grandchildren are probably going to be affected in profound ways, both physical and mental, due to climate change, because of the, obviously, the stress associated with that, geographic displacement of certain populations, all of that. So, you know, the anti-science attitude or the denial of science or the inability of our species to come to grips with big scientific issues, that's a cultural phenomenon that is going to impact us. And that's something we probably should work to deal with. We should work to overcome that kind of cultural characteristic. Am I being too broad there? I'm jumping from broad to narrow, but
it does. No, it was perfect because it leads to the next question of this, the idea of within group and between group competition and cooperation, the multi-level selection theory. Can you talk more about that and how that's just part of the evolutionary process?
So one of the changes in the field of evolutionary biology in the past few decades has been the increased interest in what's called multi-level selection theory. And that's Davidson Wilson, who you mentioned earlier, he's obviously been involved in that. And by the way, that's still controversial. That's not totally accepted. Some evolutionary biologists are still arguing against that. But the basic idea is that if you look at most evolution, at least in the past, we understood is occurring between individuals competing against one another. But in some cases, we may have populations of individuals competing against each other. And if one population has certain characteristics that make it competitively superior to another population, then that group may displace another group or may conquer another group. So we're talking about one group being selected over another group, not just individuals within a group. So that's the basic idea, right? That there's more than one level of selection. Now, how do we apply that in the modern world? That's a harder thing to say. Because frankly, I don't know at what time frames we have to think about this. Mm-hmm. So in our case as a culture, one of the reasons that the US has been able to be very successful over the past, since World War II, for example, is that we really did apply science and technology in pretty remarkable ways as a country. We put tremendous amounts of funding into scientific research. One thing that helped with this was when the Soviet Union put a satellite, Sputnik, into orbit, it just really scared people in control. And so a tremendous amount of money was put into science. And so science education increased dramatically. Mm-hmm. And several decades down the line from that, we're still benefiting from that allocation of money to do research. We are not at the present time devoting the resources that we did in the past. And partly because science has become politicized with one political party, attacking science in various aspects, whether you can talk about, anti-evolution, anti-climate change, anti-vaccinations, a host of things. What happens to a society that's in the modern world that's no longer focusing on science when it's competing with other societies that are? That's an interesting thought. Where will we be 200 years from now if the US does not continue to put resources into maintaining scientific literacy and scientific prowess?
Yeah.
Will we look back? Will descendants of people living now look back and it'd be like the British Empire, You know, something happened to the British Empire, right? You go back 200 years and the British Empire was dominant across the world. Right now, the US is pretty powerful. Now, British Empire was powerful because it was great with several things, you know, its Navy and its Industrial Revolution. The US has been very successful for a variety of reasons, our political system, but also our emphasis on science in the, particularly in the 20th century. If we don't maintain that, what's gonna happen? Will our group be outcompeted by another group? Now, you could at one point say, well, if that happens, that's the way it should be. On the other hand, if you're within this group, you want your group to do well.
Right.
So I don't think I really answered your question.
No, you did. There's a consequence to that, right? Because we live in a symbolic world. So when you're talking about, I'm just thinking about the United States between Republicans and Democrats, right? Two competing groups, and both are trying to survive, and people who storm the Capitol are thinking about, well, my whole heritage, my everything that I stand for is going away. And so there was a real threat there that created, that evoked that kind of behavior.
Right.
We have to recognize that. But that is one example of the consequence of this group competition. And when you're talking about how, you know, the UK expanded, empire expanded, and how the United States expanded other countries, we also did a lot of damage.
Absolutely.
Right?
But one of the problems with when you talk about groups competing is that groups tend to be fluid over time. And so, for example, our political lineup now is quite different than it would have been 20 years ago. You know, during the Trump administration, we became very pro-Russia, right? And that was unthinkable to the Republican Party a few decades ago, right? So groups shift, allegiances shift, and that's one of the problems with selection at the group level is our groups maintained long enough to have an impact. And that's one of the arguments that people who are against group selection would say, that there's fluidity within groups.
Yeah.
But I also agree completely with you that about the, and that's really doesn't have any, my comment doesn't have anything to do with group selection in a sense, in a way it does. The US did tremendous damage in a host of ways. So what we did to Native Americans is literally genocide.
Yeah.
And I've spent a lot of time in Mexico, Central and South America. And I speak Spanish. And if you go to other countries, what the US has done to some of our neighbors, particularly some countries in Central America, is not pretty. And we get kind of a biased view in how, you know, kids are taught in school and in our press. But if you go to other countries, you get a very different view of some of the things the US has done. So I'm glad you raised that point. Because
Well, David Sloan Wilson also brought up this term cultural catalysis, right? That cultural evolution is speeding up, is faster and faster. And he's thinking of cultural evolution and managing that framed within a kind of a compassionate, psychologically flexible network of, you know, acceptance commitment therapy involves pro-social values. But what I fear is that it's a bit so short-sighted, because what is the larger picture is cultural, biological, genetic evolution that is quickly changing naturally, right? Beyond what we can even consciously manage. And
yes.
Yeah.
So culture is speeding up. I mean, there's no question about that. You know,
yeah.
It's astonishing how things have changed. You know, Hugh, where you're sitting right there in Austin, Texas, if you go back 200 years or so, or a little more, that would have been, you know, the east side of Austin, from, you know, from the fault line there, the east side. It was a giant prairie, and there were herds of bison and pronghorn antelope were running around out there. And, you know, the only people there were Native Americans and maybe a few trappers or something. And now, two centuries later, you know, Austin is this astonishingly booming metropolis.
Right.
Culture has changed, you know, and that's a few human generations. I mean, literally a few human generations.
Yeah.
You know, my great-grandfather, okay, great-grandfather, so my grandmother's father fought in the Civil War, okay? So that's, you know, I'm one generation, my father, my grandmother, my great-grandfather, it's four generations. You go back a couple more generations and you're back to, you know, when Austin was a prairie. There were no cars, there were no computers, there were no airplanes, there were no chemicals. If you go to back when the Titanic sank,
yeah.
You know, I forget what year, was it 1911 or 1914? It was something like
1912,
that.
1912, I think, yeah.
1912?
Yeah.
There was not one piece of plastic on the Titanic. Plastic had not been invented.
Right.
Well, now, virtually everything you get is packed in plastic. And that includes, if it's in a can, the inside of the can is packed in plastic.
Yeah.
Or that has a little spraying, a plastic coating. That coating and the plastic containers that you get your food in, they have chemical compounds in there that leach into the food. Mm-hmm. And some of those compounds mimic our hormones. Mm-hmm. And so we look, for example, there's been an astonishing decrease in sperm count in men in developing countries. Mm-hmm. Astonishing over the past few decades.
Mm-hmm.
Some people think that chemical exposure is one of the big drivers of that. Now, that's a cultural change.
Mm-hmm.
We should manage that in a responsible way.
Mm-hmm.
But in our modern society, there's tremendous money interest to prevent the appropriate response to rapid cultural change.
Yeah. Yeah.
That, so we're fighting, you know, I agree with David Stone Wilson, it'd be fantastic if we can shape our response to cultural change, but
yeah.
We are facing opposing forces, and many of those forces have to do with money. It's hard to get around human nature in a sense, right? We evolved as biological organisms. There's competition.
Yeah.
And, you know, we see that in virtually any species.
Yeah.
The thing that, but however, I think there are many people who are trying to operate in altruistic ways that are doing things for the right reasons, that, you know, it may help them monetarily, but at the end of the day, that's not why they're doing what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I would just say, okay, look at you. You're doing this podcast. As best I can tell, you have the purest of motives. You're trying to share knowledge across a number of disciplines to make things better, to make the world a better place. And, you know, in one small sphere, you're trying to make the world a better place. And, you know, you're not going to make a lot of money doing a podcast, right? You're devoting time and resources. You had to buy your equipment. You know, you're spending your time. You're doing that. And I know a lot of people who are like that, who are trying to do things for the right reason.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the wonderful things about our species. We did evolve to cooperate. And, you know, it's kind of truly remarkable. Compare us to some other species. You can go, you could fly to China tomorrow, and and I've done this. I've been to China, and I don't know one word of Chinese. I mean, and I can't read one word of Chinese, but I walk down the street and I'm not attacked, right? If you were another species, if you were a chimp and you went over into the wrong territory, they'll literally rip your limbs off. So I try not to get, I try to be, try to maintain optimism, because I think while there we have all kinds of problems, there are many things that have gotten better. I have a good friend, his name is Peter Schultz. He's a environmental scientist, and we play, in a way it's a game. I'll sometimes be discouraged and he'll tell me exactly the same thing as when he's discouraged and I tell him, and that is, let's look at what's improved over the past, say, 75 years. So I'll just take in over my own life. So I grew up in the segregated South, where it was illegal to marry somebody of another race, where there was rampant homophobia. Literally, you would go into a public building and there were white and colored bathrooms. Mm-hmm. There were segregated schools, okay? If you looked at newspapers of the time, looked at environmental issues, air pollution was astonishing in certain cities. People literally died in the US in certain cities of air pollution things. Rivers caught on fire, the Cuyahoga River in somewhere in Ohio, I forget which city. It caught on fire several times in the 50s and 60s because of so much petroleum waste. Okay, fast forward to the present. We still have lots of problems, but laws and outright attacks on people because of, you know, we still have some, but horrible segregation, horrible application of racism or homophobia or whatever is nothing like it used to be. Environmental things, because of the formation of the Environmental Protection Agency, water pollution laws, whatever, our environment here is much better. So things can get better. So I try to keep that in mind. Yeah. I think it's not a futile effort to try to do things in a way that maximize human potential. I think we're fallible beings, and all we can do is try our best, but just do it in a humble way and not do it in a way that's going to, do it in a way that's going to drive us further and further into.
I agree. I mean, humans are messy, and I don't think that there is a way to break away the ego from other nurturing behaviors, what we're trying to do. And so I have no doubt that, you know, the great people in my field have the best motivations. I think that's something that we need to be aware of and talk about in our community, right? It's not overly talked about. I do want to be respectful of your time. We're almost out of time, but I do want to ask you was one last question about where you see our, culture, all the changes down the road, 10 years down the road, 50 years down the road, where do you think we're going in terms of the trends?
So I think that we're going to see the application of what I call evolutionary or ancestral health to a host of things. Mm-hmm. So I think we're going to see it to increasing health span. So I like to distinguish health span and lifespan. So we have people who can live a long time, but maybe they spend the last 10 years of their life in a nursing home. Yeah. That's not what we find in traditional groups of people. People think hunter-gatherers all died when they're young. That's not true. Hunter-gatherers often died of infections and things. If there was an injury, they didn't have any medicine, but they often lived into their 50, 60, 70s, or even potentially longer, maintaining health. And we have focused on longevity. I think when we try to, when in the future, as we apply evolutionary health more and more, we're gonna, I think health span is something that's gonna be increasingly focused on. I think we're gonna see the application of genetics to all manner of health issues. Aging in particular, but also mental health things. I think that we're going to increasingly recognize the importance of intrauterine effects. I mentioned that earlier. What happens during fetal development having profound effects later in life. I think that's going to be recognized more and more. I think that we're going to become increasingly sensitized to the effects of toxins on people, because different people are affected in different ways by toxins. And, you know, there's a whole lot that we know now, but we're not applying. So just for example, we now know that we have certain blood markers, if you can call them that. I won't go into detail. Different people are genetically variable in something called the ApoE gene. So there are people that are ApoE2, ApoE3, ApoE4. So ApoE4 makes, that's sometimes called the Alzheimer's gene. It makes people more susceptible to Alzheimer's. Have you run across that? So it turns out that if you have two copies of a particular gene, it increases your chance of getting Alzheimer's a great deal. If you have one copy, it increases your chances somewhat. Now, that doesn't mean you're going to get Alzheimer's. It means that if you live in the modern world the way many people are living, you may well develop Alzheimer's, but there are ways to mitigate that risk. It turns out that brain trauma, if you have that particular genotype, which by the way may be advantageous in some ways, if you have brain trauma, and you are an ApoE4 genotype, you probably are not going to recover as well from that brain trauma. It has to do with how the brain deals with inflammation and a host of things. So in the future, for instance, if we still have a game called football, which I doubt we'll be doing it the way we're doing it now because of, you know, the traumatic encephalopathy. And I'm sure your audience is very familiar with traumatic encephalopathy. We would probably do genetic testing on kids and say, if you're ApoE4, you shouldn't be playing football. Do some other kind of sport. You know, go into track or go into basketball. You have no business having your head. And likewise, you might not be a good candidate. If you have two copies of the ApoE4 gene, you are probably not going to want to be in any profession where you risk head trauma. In other words, I think we're going to be looking at personalized health. So we're going to have this, we're going to be shifting over from what's good for everybody to we're going to be looking more at personalized health.
Okay.
Because we're now at the level where we can do that. I mean, it seems like the future is happening now, but at a very small level. Because of my perspective with public health, we're not doing many things that I consider are low-hanging fruit that are easy to accomplish that would help so many more people.
Yeah.
So let me just give one example, and that's in the world of diet and health. Not something that I've spent a lot of time thinking about, we've really not talked about today. We are not eating like our hunter-gatherer ancestors. And that is causing profound problems for humans. One of the big problems is the epidemic of diabetes and the correlated epidemic of obesity. So, you know, we'd like to think that, you know, we're getting more and more scientific knowledge, but our health is getting worse as a nation. So I don't know the exact statistic now, but somewhere 10% of people have type 2 diabetes. There are researchers and clinicians who are now able to reverse the symptoms of a very large percentage of diabetics. But that's not being applied to the average person because there's not an understanding of what's driving diabetes. Researchers are understanding this, but unfortunately, there's something like a 15-year gap between research and application in the medical world. Mm-hmm. So we now understand much more about what a healthy diet is, and it's not what people are being told. But it's what's healthy is a diet that mimics that fairly closely of our ancestors. And the analogies, you know, what would happen if you fed a lion tofu and orange juice all the time? The lion would obviously, it wouldn't last long. It certainly wouldn't be able to reproduce properly. Well, the same thing is happening to humans when we are fed things that are inappropriate. That to me is a low-hanging fruit. Improving human diet in a way based on research, not based on what's called nutritional epidemiology, which is very poorly done. How do we apply what we now know about exercise to mental health, to maintaining mental acuity as we age? How about exposure to light? Humans are exposing themselves to light late at night. That's new in our evolutionary history. Go back 100 years, when my father was a boy, all they had was oil lamps. They didn't have a screen broadcasting tremendous amounts of blue light in their face at midnight. We need to get the toxins and pollution under control, despite the fact that there's money interest to prevent that. We need to educate so that people get vaccinations against things that can prevent childhood disease and, you know, including brain damage. You know, people have certain infections and it causes long-term mental problems. So, I mean, there is a bunch of low-hanging fruit. So I don't think we even have to go to the future. And probably one of the biggest ones is childhood nutrition. This drives me up a tree. Something like, you know, if you look at kids today, I can't remember the exact percentages, but worldwide, something like 30% of people have anemia due to iron deficiency. It's the most common nutritional deficiency worldwide. And kids in developing countries have behavioral problems because of this. Zinc deficiency. You go to places like Guatemala or India, kids, and when they grow into adults, are physically stunted because they've not had enough zinc. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons this is they eat a grain-heavy diet. You go to Guatemala, for instance, I spent a lot of time there. Corn, people, you know, in the mountainous areas, poor people, they eat tremendous amounts of corn. They have almost no meat in their diet because they can't afford it. Corn, when you grind up a grain, there are chemicals in there that bind with minerals. So these are chemicals, these are plant defense chemicals that bind with minerals. So a kid growing up in the mountains of Guatemala on a very high corn diet doesn't have the appropriate minerals. And that can cause physical stunting. They're not going to grow as tall. They're going to be, but there are also mental effects. Increased likelihood of depression, anxiety, emotional instability. This stuff is dietarily linked. So if we could just get better nutrition for children. Before the pandemic, 1 in 6 U.S. kids lived in poverty. Here, it's much higher now. Yeah. You know, the pandemic has been a disaster for child poverty. Just a disaster. So, you know, I'm torn between thinking about, okay, what are these wonderful things for the future? How can we, you know, how can we apply epigenetics to treat disease, cure cancer, you know, treat cancer, treat mental health? The other hand, how do we just keep kids from being exposed to lead? And on the other hand, giving them enough nutrition that their brains develop so that they can reach their real potential.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. And I'll kind of leave with this. It just seems like we know all the answers. There's not a real problem to be solved. This is not rocket science. The hurdle that we really do need to climb over or understand is why we do something that's against our best interest all the time.
That's exactly the problem.
Yeah. That's a problem that that's I don't think we have a full understanding about.
No.
Yeah.
It's obviously, that's a complicated, it's okay. You can state the problem simply, but the resolution of that problem is very complicated.
Yes. Thank you so much for being here. It was wonderful. It was really, really good.
It's been a real pleasure, and it's great to actually see you after 30 years.
I know, yeah. And the amazing thing is, what neither of us really look over the age of 30.
Hey, boy, you're a very nice guy, Hugh. What, this white stuff? What is that? You know?
Yeah, everybody gets gray hair.
That's right.
It's wonderful. So I'd like to remain in touch with you and find out what's going on.
Great. It's been a real pleasure being with you and your audience.
Yeah, thank you. All right. Spit on the ground, hold your breath, try to scare yourself to death. Bury your bones under the dirt and tear your heart and rip your shirt and stomp your feet in disgust. Curse the gray skies if you must, but you'll find when you are done, blue skies for everyone. And dig up your wine, break your heart, and give up the race before you start. Drop your drawers and roll around, burn your house right to the ground. Go to sleep, hit your head, scream until your face is red, but you'll find when you are done, blue skies for everyone.